Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Wandering Road Podcast. I'm your host Chris, alongside my co-host Dean, and for today's show, we are joined by a very special guest, JJ from the Southern Demonology Podcast.
How are you doing tonight,
well,
JJ?
How are y'all doing?
We're doing great. We're glad to have you on the show. I think you're our second big time guest that we've had on the show. We've had like a TikToker on that's had over a few hundred thousand followers. Very excited to have you on today's show.
Well, I don't know if I would classify myself as big time or not, but I appreciate it.
We'll count it. Yeah.
Nah, compared
to us,
compared to us, yeah, definitely. All right, man. So let's jump right into it. How did you get into the paranormal? Did you have like any experiences while you were young? What drew you to paranormal stuff and demons?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's kind of a disjointed answer. I mean, you would think that there would be a solid line of continuity between my younger years, my academic years, and later in life, but it kind of joins back up in the middle. So I grew up in the smallest town in Tennessee, population 113 people, and this is a part that is underneath the shadow of the Cumberland Plateau. Very wild weather. It's all Scott-Irish in nature, and we're also, most of us happen to be at least part Native American. And we live underneath these giant Indian burial mounds all over the place. And I grew up in a very haunted house. We called the spirit Patrick. Whether it was there or not, I don't know. But I had a lot of really strange experiences. I had some as a kid with some of the land that is right around our house. And I don't know if it was from that, if it was from burying my own headstone when I was 6 years old in the family graveyard, but something infected me with the urge to tell and the love for ghost stories. And I would tell them everywhere. Well, I kind of grew out of that, went to college, had a few paranormal experiences there. I went to one of the a college that was older than the country by 4 months. So very ancient place, at least by our standards. But what really got me into it was I started studying ancient Semitic languages, and I love that, and happened across a body of literature, or two different bodies of literature, that kind of drew me in. Now, the first was the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the second was the Pseudepigrapha, which is the collection of texts written in between the Hebrew Bible and the Christian New Testament. And I don't know how much you know about Second Temple Judaism, but it's where you get a lot of the really strange ideas that had never been in ancient Judaism, but you still find all the remnants of those ideas kind of crystallized and embedded even into our current understanding of demons and spirits and everything else. And it's just beautiful. So that it's a long-winded answer, but that is how I got into it all.
Hey, can I ask you real quick? That's a really fascinating story. And one thing that popped out in the beginning, you made that note about burying your headstone when you were 6 years old. Can you talk about, I've heard of that before, but I don't really remember exactly what that entails. Is that kind of like a spiritual act, or is that just something you kind of did? Can you talk more to that?
Oh, yeah, sure. So it's really nothing spiritual related. It's more of a fact that the graveyard, well, where I grew up, there's a church which is essentially the buckle of the Bible Belt. There's a church every 2 miles. There's a graveyard even closer than that. You know, it's kind of ridiculous. I grew up mowing my ancestors' graveyards because the churches were so tiny. They just did not have the manpower or person power, however you want to call it, to be able to handle that. So my grandmother and elder relatives took that job on. But no, it was simply the fact that in the church that our family is buried at, we don't go to it. We're not affiliated with it. That's just where a lot of our family happens to be. And the great thing is, in the area that we're from, there's demand, but there's no charge to be buried in these places. All you have to do is to make sure that you stake out your claim. When I was a kid, we spray painted our names onto cinder blocks, loaded a whole bunch of them into this aging GMC truck that my grandmother had, drove out to the graveyard, and then it was pretty much a family affair of all of us started burying these cinder blocks with our names on them in order to claim our stake. That was pretty much all it was.
That's so fascinating. And I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, where never even heard of anything like that. So that's really, thank you for sharing that. That's so interesting. Chris, did you have anything you wanted to ask?
And I grew up in New York City,
where everyone's buried in the bottom of the lake.
Before either. The Hudson River, get it right. Yeah, I did want to ask you something, JJ. You mentioned earlier in your answer that you grew up in a haunted house. You mind sharing some of the experiences that you had growing up there?
We were dirt poor. There's no other way to blanket that. The house that we lived on, it was a log cabin, the logs of which had been around for 200 plus years, and it had been transported from location to location a few times in its life. But yeah, it was reassembled into this very simple kind of structure, and my mom, my grandmother, and I lived there. And we had this upstairs attic. And that's what everyone avoided, like the plague. I have been in the house. We would have the windows and the doors closed. And yet that attic door would swing open by itself multiple times in a row, even though there's no wind sources whatsoever that would prompt that. And I have had some of the most horrible dreams. In fact, I had a dream of the day that I would die. I still fear that day every single year when it comes up, because I'm like, oh crap, don't tell me that was prophetic or not. I certainly hope not. I hope it was just a dream. But have you ever seen Children of the Corn?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That that is in the movie. We had, nothing related to that, but we had a gigantic oil-framed picture. I guess they got it from a flea market or something. That barn looked exactly like the one that's in that movie. And the weird part is that there was a doorway that's depicted in the picture, and the door is slightly ajar, and you can see a small little prick of light that was painted coming from that door jamb. And I would swear I would see that get brighter or dimmer based upon whatever's going on. There were a lot of different stories around that. And not just of that house. Almost every parcel of land had some story about it. I've had experiences with my front door neighbor's house, and yeah, it was kind of crazy.
So you've been essentially surrounded by this sort of thing.
Nothing earth shattering, but
you've essentially been surrounded by this sort of thing for your entire life. Do you think that shaped you, or that probably shaped you quite a bit as a person, but you're saying that that's what drew you in to the spiritual side and being interested in demonology and whatnot. But I have to ask you, with the dream that you had about your possible prophetic death, did you see yourself clearly, and do you recall what you looked like in that dream? Because that'd be really fascinating, you know, when you were younger, you dreamt of yourself looking older. And I'm just curious to learn more about that story. That's really interesting to me and kind of honestly scary.
Oh, yeah. So the bed that I was sleeping in, the beds were actually in the living room, because we didn't have separate bedrooms except for one, which my grandmother lived in. So I dreamt that I woke up from my bed. The attic door, which was right across from my bed, was opened, and this cold wind was pouring out of it. And I happened to look over to my left, and that's where this old picture of my great-grandfather was hung. It's probably taken in the 1930s. And that picture had always freaked me out. And he was looking at me from this picture, and the eyes were glowing portals. And it was him that spoke to me and said, "You will die on November 2nd. And I didn't see myself. I didn't picture myself dying. It was him telling me when I was going to die. Now, whether that is true or not, I highly doubt it. I don't sit here and claim to be a medium or a sensitive or anything of the sort. It was sufficiently scary that it has stuck with me, and I can remember it so clearly, even, 30 plus years afterwards.
Now, was that a one-time dream?
It was a one-time thing, yes.
Did it happen? It was a one-time thing. So, okay, gotcha. It was like one of those really vivid dreams that just stuck.
Yeah, well, I have been plagued with nightmares my entire life. In fact, my dreams alternate between either the really mundane or something so bizarre, it's not even funny. It's not uncommon for nightmares to be, high up on my list of experiences.
Do you think you attribute something like that with your dreams to the fact that you were surrounded by so much spirituality and death growing up? Or do you think that you have a closer connection to the other side than the average person?
Oh, no, I do not think that I have a closer connection to anything, honestly. I think it was more of the fact that I grew up loving monsters and mythology and creatures and ghosts, and that was pretty much what my mind has been stuck in ever since. So, yeah, it's just really more of the subject matter that I have been interested in, more so than being able to, see things that other people cannot. I will never make that claim.
And this is kind of just a fun question, but do you remember the first horror movie that you saw when you were growing up? And
Yes, I do. Do y'all remember a very obscure film by the name of Monster in the Closet?
Yes. Oh my God, that's an old classic. I barely remember that. Can you tell us about that, though, the synopsis?
Oh, my God. Yeah, so that is, it's really more of a horror comedy. But when I was 6 years old, we were going to go see a film, and we rarely went to movies, so this was a huge treat. And we got, my mom, my grandmother, and I got to the movie theater, and they were like, "Okay, what movie do you want to see?" And I saw Monster in the Closet, and I'm like, "I've got to go see that one." And they were like, "Nope, you're going to get nightmares." I said, "I don't care. I want to see that movie." This movie, it's the most stupid premise in the world. There is a monster with two heads, one gigantic one, and it has this huge gaping maw in which its mouth, lower mouth, rests upon its chest. And out of that hole, another little head will pop out and go, and this thing could teleport between closets. And that was the main kind of, scary thing. Then the monster falls in love with the male protagonist. And yeah, it gets really wonky. But for some reason, that movie scared the absolute bejesus out of me. Like,
well, now we also know now where Pixar stole its Monsters, Inc. idea, because that's really funny.
Pretty much. You got that right.
Right.
Oh, man. My first horror movie, probably the worst thing you could have a kid watch at like 10 years old.
Oh, no. The Exorcist. That is, oh, my God. That's literally like one of the top rated horror movies of all time. That is terrifying.
Absolutely. Especially, have y'all seen the Exorcist, the version you've never seen? No. That's literally the title of it. It's really good. They add in a whole bunch of cut footage from the original. It's amazing. It amps up the creepiness by a factor of 10. I love that version. Absolutely. Even though they they massacred the reputation of Pazuzu in that film, which is not correct, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the books, too, of the Exorcist books, so hopefully they add more stuff from the books on there.
Well, don't hope for that with the new movie coming out, Exorcist Believe.
Oh, I've been wanting to see that. Bad reviews?
I don't know about the reviews, and I refuse to touch it with the WGA strikes coming on, because I don't want to, you know, support the studios until they capitulate. Yeah. However, just seeing the trailers, it's a gimmick film. Yeah. What you can almost hear the writers in the room going, what would be scarier than one little girl possessed? Oh, I know. Let's make it two of them. Like, oh, okay. That doesn't do anything for me. Yeah. I'm sorry. Especially after getting to watch the one movie that probably depicts demonic possession the best of any film I have ever seen. Have y'all seen Nefarious?
Okay, that sounds familiar.
Nefarious? No,
I would recommend watching Nefarious. It's amazing. I was told about this film from actually Father Birdsong, who's an exorcist in Georgia. And that night after we finished our conversation, I went and watched this. And holy crap, it's amazing. Because one of the biggest complaints that I have around demonic possession films is the fact that they always have these very involved subplots of, oh, well, this is the priest's life. And, you know, oh, these are the things going around them. It doesn't matter. If you're dealing with a true demonic possession, you already have everything that you need to tell a story. And if you are a director who's not competent enough to do so, then something's wrong. And Nefarious does exactly that. Now, it's not a perfect film. However, you've got just two people in a room, and that's the entire movie. And it's just, it's amazing. Yeah. It really is. I highly recommend it. I see
it's rated really well. And you know what? Something else that popped up in the list I'm looking at now might be another jumping off point for discussion, because I know you have a lot of knowledge in Judaism and whatnot, but this, you've probably seen this movie, but maybe you haven't. It's called The Offering. Are you familiar with that?
I've seen a couple of these. Let me make sure that this is the one that I'm thinking that it is.
It just came out.
Yes, I have. We have a Discord server, and a lot of Wednesdays we'll do a streaming offering. And I had a person come in and suggest watching this film. Holy crap. It is amazing. I was really impressed by this.
I was impressed as well. And I'm not easily impressed with horror movies. My general rule of thumb is if the IMDb is like above 6, I'll give it a chance. But this is interestingly 5.2 on IMDb, but I thought it was really well done and super interesting because it was from the perspective of Hasidic Jews. And I think in New York City, and that's something you don't ever see in a horror movie, like, you know, demons from Jewish religion. And I can't remember the exact demon from that story, but from what you saw in that, how close to that on the Jewish side, the Jewish religious side of the spiritual context, would you say, how well did they do that?
They seem to have done that extremely well. Now, a lot of that, like a lot of the quote unquote demons that you will find within modern Judaism, no matter what type of division you happen to be in, whether, you know, it's Hasidic, you know, whatever, they, a lot of those are drawn from later traditions, such as the Midrash or anything else. And, but at least, according to, because the person who recommended this film, she is of the Jewish faith, and we actually got to talking afterwards, and she's like, yeah, this is pretty much textbook. So I relied upon her expertise for that. But I mean, you do get a few films that are starting to deal with this now. You know, anything that are dealing with like Dibbuk, especially, I know that's kind of ignited a lot of imaginations around the world with a few movies out there. And just like Jen, Dybbuk are fascinating. Like, I actually had an interview with a lady who specializes in folklore, and she claimed to actually have been possessed by a Dybbuk and was actually on an interview just last week, in which the exorcist involved in that particular case claimed that they were dealing with a person who was possessed by a djinn. And the thing is about Dybbuk and djinn, I mean, they're not demons, and they don't necessarily have any ill will toward the individual. They're just usually can be highly selfish in nature. It was a really interesting conversation.
So I'm glad you actually brought that up, because that segues into another question I wanted to ask you about demonology in general and just the topic of demons, obsession, and possession. So you mentioned the Dybbuk and the djinn, which I'm a huge fan of. Well, not huge fans of the djinn, but of Chris, the story.
Chris, what's that shrine?
If any djinn,
Chris, what's that shrine
this,
in the background?
Leave me alone. Leave me alone. That's my cat tree. So I No, if there's any, no djinn are welcome here. No. Would you say Dybbuk, obviously djinn, according to Islam, they were made of smokeless fire. And, you know, there's angel, there's djinn, there's man. They're three separate beings created by God. But for the context of demons and demonology, are demons, in your opinion, or from what you've learned from your academic studies, are they one and the same, or are they completely separate? To you, do they all exist in the same spiritual world?
That is a very complex question. I love the question. So I myself come from a Judeo-Christian perspective, and the demonology that you find within both, surprisingly, actually stem from Zoroastrianism. And in Zoroastrianism, you've got two camps. You've got the good camp of Ahura Mazda, and you have the bad camp of Ahriman. And that was kind of translated and carried along. And you find that within Second Temple Judaism, within Christianity, with Mandaism, and it keeps going on. So if you're coming from that perspective, there really are only two camps. You've got the good and you've got the evil. Now, in Islam, there's a lot more variations cast upon the djinn. You can have good djinn, you can have evil djinn, you can have indifferent djinn. So it doesn't have quite that same black and white worldview that has been passed down through Zoroastrianism, interestingly enough. Now, there are later traditions, especially within Judaism, in which does kind of make that distinction, because you have otherworldly beings out there, such as Dybbuk, which are, not, you know, it's not inherently evil, but it's also definitely not good. So it resides more in the selfish phase of the world. But yeah, I would say that, to me, demons are things that are solely after the corruption and ruination of souls. Whether that means that there can, you know, that djinn are always demons, or is there something else masquerading? Who knows? Because at the end of the day, even if we do get evidence, typically that evidence is coming from, you know, demons. You can't trust what a demon says ever, and we certainly can't see the things, so who knows?
Yeah, and one thing that kind of has always interested me about the idea of good and evil spirits, and I apologize to step out of the realm of Judeo-Christianity, but if you think back to other stories like across the ages, like say animalism or some other more ancient religion, like possibly on the Hindu side, they do have a lot of evil spirits as well that don't necessarily translate over to Judeo-Christianity. However, there are some similarities. So from your perspective, what do you think about demonology kind of, if you know anything about this, you may not have a speciality in this, but what do you think personally about the bleeding over of multiple religions and over the ages, you know, for thousands of years, kind of the ebbing and flowing and the morphing of the idea of what good and evil spirits are and what they do? Because as we know, in a lot of religions and even in Catholicism, there are different saints or components that have different responsibilities to do different blessings and different things. And the same with other religions where they have spirits that are responsible for, you know, hunger and starvation, but also happiness and wealth and stuff like that. So how do you think that across the human ages, demonology has kind of morphed and changed? And do you think that it's completely different from what you see as more of the truth from the Christianity perspective? Or do you think that they all do kind of bleed over and they all could exist across multiple religions?
So I don't, when it comes to answering whether these things exist in a quote unquote objective metaphysical reality, I have no knowledge. I've never encountered a demon. I'm kind of glad that I haven't. I hope that does not change anytime soon, etc. However, I will say two things on that front. The first is that Hinduism, which you brought up, has been kind of directly influenced in perhaps an inverse way from Zoroastrianism. The two have been reacting to each other ever since the very beginning of their religions. And that's because they both sprung up from the same Proto-Iranian group that originated in about the 19th century BCE. And you'll find that the gods of Hinduism are the demons of Zoroastrianism and vice versa.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head, JJ, because I'm half Indian and my grandmother was a devout Hindu. And in one of the podcasts that I did with my cousin, like, we actually talked about, because I'm a Catholic, my mother is Catholic, and I was born and raised a Catholic my entire life, but I was exposed to Hinduism. And when I did a show with my cousin, I think that was like episode 5, we talked about his Vedic beliefs and whatnot. He actually did make that comparison. So I'm glad you actually brought that up, that the Hindu gods, I think there's the Devas and the Asuras, and in Zoroastrianism, it's kind of like flipped. But I'm
I'm glad you said that. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And the fact that, you know, Zoroastrianism is just fascinating in and of itself because it has the oldest religious texts in the world, bar none. I mean, by a factor of centuries. We're not talking about, oh, it's got barely edged out. No. It is the oldest by and far. And because of the war that Julius Caesar waged against Zoroastrian priests, they have lost so much knowledge over the centuries as well. There are portions of the Hebrew Bible that we just don't understand anymore. We don't have the context for. We think that we do, but the true meaning has been kind of lost to the sands of time. Well, for Zoroastrianism, that is vast swaths of their entire literature. It's kind of sad. Although Zoroastrianism has certain centers of studies in several locations in the world, such as, you know, L.A., Chicago, some in the Northeast, it's pretty much living solely within India now, which is, you know, I think it's still more of that kind of give and take. A lot of the demonology does originate from Zoroastrianism, and that kind of began with Judaism after the Babylonian exile. That's where they came into contact with Zoroastrianism, and you see that evidenced in a lot of different ways. So I think that we, you know, a lot of the Judeo-Christian concepts of demonology does stem from that because Zoroastrianism had probably the most advanced dualism of any religion at that point in time. Now, I am not a fan of a kind of Joseph Campbell universalism, that human experience is the same because there are underlying archetypes or whatever BS that he liked to spew. I think that there are commonalities to human experience, But, you know, I don't think that, oh, you know, there's a story of a flood and so many different religions because, you know, it's just something inbuilt into humanity. I don't really buy that part. Or at least if I did, I would need a great deal of evidence to support something like that, rather than just manufacturing an idea because it sounds close enough to maybe be true.
So I always found it really fascinating, the different concepts that kind of bleed over from theology and philosophy and the different perspectives on the world and whatnot. But I think that one particular thing that interested me the most is this idea that some people can give power to spirits and demons and whatnot by just by paying attention to them. And I'm wondering, from the academic perspective, which you've seen in your studies, do you think that that is true based off of, well, not you personally, but what do you see from the text? Is it more true from the text that these spirits, like you said, they're out to get, they're malevolent, they want to disrupt people, or they look for corruption or whatever. Do they need power from humans in order to grow stronger? Is that why in contextually they're obsessed with it? Or do they kind of just go along with the flow, and if someone pays attention, it doesn't matter, they just kind of get a rise out of it?
So there's nothing really textual that I could point to and give you an answer. Okay, so let's take it from this approach. Did you know that there is no word for demon in the Hebrew Bible?
I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
They do
I
not
didn't
appear.
Know that either.
The closest that you can come is the word sha'ir, which kind of means like a pan type of goat demon thing, maybe, if you stretch it. But there are references to demons that you find, and they're normally underneath allusions, such as the arrow that flieth by day from Psalm 91, which is an allusion to Lilith, actually. You do find those, but really, in ancient Judaism, there was no enemy. It was just God, and God controlled everything, the good, the bad, the ugly. The lion spirit from God, that was from God. It wasn't from an enemy. I know people like to point to Job and go, oh, but that's Satan and arguing with God. No, it's not. It is ha-satan. There is never a word Satan in Hebrew. It is ha-satan, which means the chief prosecutor. It is a prosecutor arguing with God to make his case. It's a highly legalistic term. So you don't find an enemy. And in fact, once people brought back these ideas about Zoroastrianism, that there must be an enemy to God. Otherwise, why would Israel be going through so much horrendous heartbreak and had the first temple destroyed? There were probably a couple of centuries where they had no idea who this enemy could be, and they were just throwing names at the wall. You had everything from Baal-Zebub, who was a god of healing / disease. You had Belial. The list just keeps going on and on. I've got an entire episode about that. And I need to do a part two because the names just keep kind of stretching out into infinity until finally people landed upon a name and then they kind of ran with it.
When I hear a story like that, it just absolutely blows my mind because, and it's kind of like, I say this kind of like joshingly, but I do believe in the positivity of the human spirit, but it's just funny to me that humans could take a concept that was kind of very one-sided, but also very original from, you know, having one source of God as the sole source of everything, and kind of changing that into, well, because we're having some issue, there must be some other force other than God, since God is good and we need something to blame. And that seems like the evolution of these stories about malevolent spirits that are separate from God. Yeah, I just had to make that comment because I find that fascinating, like that branching off from the kind of the de facto dualist idea where there's good and evil, like there's God and the devil or whatever. But you're saying that in the original context, there was no evil, malevolent source separate from God. Everything flowed from God.
Yeah. In fact, it's not until Second Temple that you get the very beginning of the creation story kind of retold. Because, you know, in the beginning, Bereshith, God separated the heavens from the earth and water. Well, it's that water God never banished the water. He just kind of pushed it back to reveal the firmament. And in Second Temple Judaism, it's that water that comes to resemble chaos. That is the source of where all the bad things are coming from. And you find that with the Leviathan, the beasts that are coming out from the deep, those signify the chaos of the world that's trying to swallow everything back
together.
It kind
of seems like a perspective of equilibrium. You know, like, so God created all the dynamics of the universe, but in order to have the dynamics work the proper way, you would have to have that ebb and flow of positive and negative. So it's not necessarily that these things are inherently evil. It's just that they're a part of the necessary dichotomy of nature itself. I don't know. That's just what I get from that story. I don't know.
Well, and the thing is that it's not even an ebb and flow. It is a, this is the way things were stood at the beginning. They were good. Bad things began to encroach. And it's because of those bad things that the world is going to end. So it's like everything started, you know, everything was pushed back. It was all good to go. And then things came along to ruin creation. And that's going to spell the eventual demise of everything. You find it in First Enoch. You find it within the eschatology of Zoroastrianism, of Second Temple Judaism. Continues on into Christianity. The concept of apocalypse has been with us for centuries, if not millennia, and it's probably always going to be with us.
Yeah, that's terrifying and fascinating.
But I did have a question I wanted to ask you, JJ, specifically with regards to demonic possession and exorcisms. Are you familiar with the exorcist, Father Gabriel Amorth?
Oh, yes.
I think he passed away in 2016.
And then there's that wretched movie that came out about him, which really just, it was awful. I mean, it did him such a disservice. It's not even funny.
Is that the one with Russell Crowe? I've been meaning to watch it, yeah, so I think I might avoid it now.
The only hero from that film is the tiny little Vespa that managed to support Russell Crowe's weight during that film.
Oh, hell flame fired, man. Jeez.
Oh, man.
That's hilarious. Oh, my God. Well, I know who we're never having on our podcast ever.
But
sorry, I'm not trying to throw y'all or anything.
It's all good.
No, you're good. But what I did want to ask was, I was looking at some documentaries on Father Amorth, and he made the claim that the quote unquote the devil is already in the Vatican. That the Vatican itself is so entrenched with, I guess, I don't know how to say it. I don't want to say like they're devil worshipers or anything like that, but they're so entrenched with materialism. And I guess that what he was trying to say was like the demonic side of things, that the bishops and the cardinals and whatnot, they just essentially made deals with the devil for their wealth and attaining their position. What do you make of those claims, given that you know, on your podcast, you've talked to exorcists, you've studied demonology and whatnot, your opinion?
It's not the first time people have claimed this. Are y'all familiar with Malachi Martin?
No. Sure.
Can you Malachi enlighten us? Martin wrote probably one of the most pivotal books that explored demonic possession in recent memory. He was an advisor to several popes. He was a Jesuit. And then he left the Jesuits. He begged the Pope to be freed from a couple of his vows, one of which was the vow of poverty, so he could actually make a living. And he went off and he was still able to perform masses because he did not disavow himself of that particular vow. And he began to write a lot of controversial works. One of them is Hostage to the Devil, which that one really kind of changed my life. I read this book in college, I think my junior year, and I had nightmares for about 6 months after the fact. It is extremely powerful because it takes the view from the possessed person, the view from the priest who conducted the rite, and then the exorcism itself. And then at the end, it goes over a lot of theology regarding these things. And Martin also gave a lot of interviews there. I think he gave at least six to Art Bell back in the day. And those are absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I'll have to check those out. I'm a huge fan of Art Bell.
Oh, I am too. So
I loved his Coast to Coast.
Yeah, it's just too bad that whatever Coast to Coast AM has morphed into now is so abysmal. Unless you believe in the hollow earth and that Nephilim live amongst us and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, enough of my grudge against current incarnation of that. But no, Martin, he wrote a book, I think it's called The House of Leaves, in which he directly accused a lot of the Catholic leadership to be Satan worshipers and already infiltrated by the demonic for a very, very long time. It's very hard to get a hold of that book now because it's out of print and it's never been digitized, but it's well worth a read. But I mean, these kind of legends have been going on for centuries. In fact, there was one pope who was accused of actually being a Satan worshiper and an active mage. So it's, yeah, these things have long played the church. I don't think they're going away anytime soon.
Yeah, from my perspective as a historian, I have 2 degrees in history. I wanted to originally be a history professor, and I'm into the Crusades and whatnot, and looking into how the church handled itself from its inception all the way to the Middle Ages up until now, one can see how those questions are brought up because, for God's sake, like, popes had battle armor. Like, you're supposed to be the leader of a faith that, you know, talks about, you know, loving thy neighbor, giving to the poor, but yet you're here with a battle armor and a spear leading armies into combat. But
exactly. In fact, you now have to watch The Pope's Exorcist. I would love to have a conversation about it because I'm not trying to give spoilers away, but the Crusades do come up and it makes the most ridiculous claims around that. It's a fascinating thing to be able to think about how absolutely tone deaf the movie is. This is why a lot of Catholic theologians and even those who are exorcists absolutely deadpan the movie. They're like, no, this is made a mockery of the church, of Father Amorth in so many different ways. It's not even laughable.
Did you have something to add?
No, man, that's really good stuff. And, you know, I don't know if you guys want to stick on this topic for longer, if you have more questions, that's great. But one thing I would love to do before we run out of time, I don't know if this is too hard of a switchover, but so I'm actually going to Japan for the first time. Yeah. Time going to Japan in a short amount of time. I think, in about a month or so, my wife and I are going to go, and I always loved Japanese culture for the longest time. I grew up watching anime. I actually didn't go the linguist route for Japanese. I started learning Mandarin instead, but I did have a lot of interest invested in Japan, still do. But I've always been fascinated with, like, the Asia Pacific ghost stories and whatnot. And I see in your interview questions list that you have a little bit of expertise on the Japanese ghost side. So do you have any advice for me or anything I should look out for as I traverse the Japanese landscape?
Yes. Yes, I do.
You beat me to it, Dean. You beat me to it. I was about to ask him to go into his ghostly attack in Tokyo. And to Sweet. Segue right into awesome. Japanese ghosts and monsters. So perfect timing.
So first, do you know where you're going in Japan?
Yeah, so we have an itinerary. We're trying to plan it out as best as possible because we do have a good chunk of time, but we're trying to see as much as we can because we probably won't get back for a while. But we're going to start in Tokyo, obviously. We're going to do, like, I think 2 or 3 nights at a really nice or not a really nice, but like a decently nice business hotel where they have, like, all you can eat ikura. Which I don't know if you know what ikura is, but it's basically salmon roe. We're like, that's all we eat that so much here. It's probably really bad for us. So we're doing that for a few nights, and then we're going to go take the bullet train down to the Shinkansen, down to Osaka, and then we'll be in Osaka for like 4 nights or so. And then we're going to travel up to the really old town of Kobe. And I'm really looking forward to that part because I guess Kobe is like, I think it's like as far, dates as far back to 1400 or something like that.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
Right after that is Kyoto. And then from Kyoto, we're going to go back to Tokyo.
Oh, that sounds like a, such a good time. I really hope you enjoy that. A few things. Do not walk near graveyards. And if you do, get salt. Get purified salt. And leave them at your entranceways in small bowls. Because, and I scoffed at this. Now, most Japanese people, they absolutely believe in yurei, which are spirits. And when I went there, even though I am a believer, I didn't really put too much stock in the whole graveyard thing. Because I grew up in graveyards. They don't bother me at all. They're rather comforting to me. And the place where I lived, because I lived in Japan for about 2 years, and I go back now that the country's open, I go back every year or so. The place where I lived, it was right next door to a very old graveyard. And I would walk by there every single day, no problem at all. Till I had the most terrifying encounter I have ever had. And I have, at that point, I refused to walk next to graveyards. And if I did, I made sure to have a big bag of salt on hand. I also went to, and especially if y'all are dealing with these types of supernatural, preternatural, preternatural topics, highly recommend getting an omori, which you can go to any temple, especially if you're in Tokyo. You can go to either Meiji Temple or Sensoji, and you can buy these different charms that they have, which are omori, and they have a bunch of different types. But the ones that I always get are protection from evil, because yeah, I always take pretty, with the subject matter that I deal with, and I've suffered attacks from it, I always make sure to have them around, along with some other Catholic paraphernalia that I have.
Feel free to say you don't want to talk about it, but what exactly did you see? Like, what was the experience, and was it really personal, or was it kind of from a distance?
Oh, no, it was highly personal. So, I lived in a very popular part of the city where I could actually see Tokyo Tower, which is a miniature version of the Eiffel Tower, from my balcony. And I was up all night working. I love everything about Japan but the business culture. You work constantly. For 2 years, I was just, yeah, I never stopped working for that entire 2 year period. But anyway, I was up all night working, and I finally went to sleep around 5 or so in the morning. And I dreamt that there was an entity on my balcony, and it was screaming at me, "Haeru, haeru, haeru." I didn't know what that word meant. And the thing is that the sound that transmitted out of this thing's mouth, I didn't hear it with my ears. It was almost as if it was being lodged as spikes deep within my mind. And it hurt. Like, I have died in dreams before. That's not a big deal. It's scary, but you feel no pain. Like, you know that you should be feeling pain, and you don't. I do not lucid dream to save my life. I've never had a lucid dream. So I just accept that as reality and went, oh, okay, I guess it's supposed to hurt. So, ow, but you don't feel it. I felt this. It was horrible. And then I woke up a few minutes later from when I originally fell asleep to an earthquake alarm going off on my phone. And I remembered that word. And this is why I give any of this credence, because A, of the pain. B, I ran to my Japanese dictionary and looked it up. And of course, haeru means enter. This thing was screaming to be let in. And I knew that if I let that door open, I would no longer be here. And that is what made me truly believe I will never walk past that graveyard again.
Now, that is really intense.
JJ, you made me get my rosary, man. Like, What did this thing look like?
It was transparent.
Or you don't.
Like I could see a vague outline of it, and it was humanoid shaped. So it wasn't a demon. It wasn't a, well, it could have been a Tengu. Who knows what it was? But it, I didn't sense any particular malice from it. It just needed in, and that's the only thing that I could tell about this thing.
Well, I'm definitely going to watch out for that. We're actually staying in an onsen in Kobe. And the onsen, I think, is at least a couple hundred years old. Maybe not that old. At least 100 years old. It looks pretty antique. So I imagine a lot of foot traffic and souls have gone through there in and out, and hoping that's. Watch that be like the least concerning. I'm gonna be like in downtown Tokyo, and I'll see the most horrific thing, like surrounded by robots and shit. It'll surprise you.
If you ever go to Ikebukuro in Tokyo, then which is a business sector. But my God, the Sunshine 60 building, it is one of the most haunted locations in Tokyo. And it's a gigantic skyscraper. It's filled with Yorinji, amusement parks, a whole bunch, and an aquarium, and a whole bunch of different stuff. But yet, the site in which that building was built upon is an execution ground. And you get a lot, and I haven't experienced anything there, but they say if you're there at night, you better watch out. But if you're staying at an onsen, good on you. I love onsen. My favorite one happens to be in Hanako Kane, which is outside of Tokyo. Oh, God, I live there practically when I'm there.
I can't wait
there
for those hot water baths.
We did stay at a ryokan, which is a Japanese inn, shortly after going to Japan in the beginning. And I had been dying to go to Aokigahara. Do y'all know what that place is? It's the suicide forest at the base of Mount Fuji.
Heard of that. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That place scared the ever-living bejesus out of me. But anyway, but we stayed at this ryokan, which was rather old, and it was right in the shadow of Mount Fuji. And this place scared me. Like, it had a lot of twists and turns. Most of it was dimly lit. And I just knew that I was not going to come out of that place alive. Luckily, we all kind of stayed in one room together, so it wasn't nearly as bad. And we stayed to the very lighted ways. But yeah, you can find some really strange ryokan there. And there are so many good Japanese horror stories that happen in ryokan. It's not even funny.
Here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a Wandering Road Southern Demonology collab. And we're going to podcast near a Japanese cemetery.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I thought you were setting this up for a Japanese ghost story yourself, because you're like, I never thought I would make it out of there. And I thought you're going to be like, and I didn't.
I wish I was that good, but no, I'm not. I'm very much good. Alive. Yeah. Thank goodness.
Note to myself, I'm a huge fan of the Sengoku Jidai era, to never buy any combat use katanas from
And you know, that's one of the biggest differences between Western ghost stories and Eastern ghost stories, especially Japanese, because if you happen to get a spirit attached to you, you're more than likely never going to come out of that situation alive, ever. And it's sheer happenstance. Now, if you go off and invite something in, that's one thing, that's on you. But there are so many ghost stories of people picking up a random object, you know, a ruby ring on the side of the street, an umbrella, and that suddenly becomes the site of attachment that opens them up to absolute jigoku, hell. It's amazing.
Okay, yeah, so I'll definitely keep that in mind, because I'm always on sword websites and looking at katanas and old katanas. Because I'm just a huge fan of like samurai in that time period and Japanese history. I'm a huge like fan of Japan as well. One of my dreams is actually to go out there and go to, I think in Kyoto, they have this samurai museum where they let you like dress in like armor and stuff. but maybe I'll think twice about doing that with regards to attachments.
Most of those like amusement park type of things, which are kind of recreations of old towns, and those are usually, there's nothing ancient about them because they're not going to risk historical monuments or anything or artifacts. So yeah, you should be completely safe on that stuff. In fact, in a lot of those types of towns, they will have kind of reenactments of a dore of thieves trying to rob somebody, and you know, becomes a huge kind of spectacle.
I also noticed in your drop down list here that it says you list out the Japanese ghosts, but you also reference monsters. So I'm interested to hear really quickly, what would you say the difference is between Japanese ghosts and monsters? Are monsters spiritual in any way? Or are they kind of like our Bigfoot, where there could be some like spiritual side to it possibly, but it's mostly seen as like an actual physical being? But then what's the origin of that being?
So, yeah, that's a good question. So, yurei are the ghosts or the spirits, and then bakemono are, or yokai, those are the actual monsters. And there's can be some bleeding between the two. Some bakemono can be more spiritual in nature rather than bodied forms. But usually they are monsters or you know, body corporeal things, and spirits are not. And there are so many even modern day examples of both. Like these are not there are the classics such as like a kamikaze obake, which is the umbrella monster, or the lantern monster. You get a lot of those. But then you get very modern versions of these things still popping up. When I was in, I spent a month in Tokyo visiting my in-laws there, and we were watching a Japanese TV show that was talking about new yurei and bakemono. One of them was Hyako Hyako, which was it pictured a guy who was typing to his computer, just having a good old time, and he kept hearing like come up in the background, and he turns around and he sees a spirit, a spirit's head like appearing at the window and then descending. And he lived on the second floor, and it was this thing jumping up and looking into his window trying to get at him. And then in terms of monsters, there was really weird one. I forget what its name was, but it was a motorcycle riding zombie who was dressed in samurai armor and wielding a katana. And it was terrorizing people in, I don't remember if it was Kyoto or Tokyo, but it was wild. I'm like, there's no way in hell. But sure enough, it was an urban legend that was just running amok.
That's cool. So, yeah, that was just Yakuza getting drunk. Yakuza just got drunk and did some stupid stuff. Oh, man.
I wouldn't doubt that. Tokyo Drift, bakemono.
But real quick, JJ, with continuing on Japanese ghosts, I know we're a little over an hour here. We'll wrap up here shortly. What are Tengu and what are Oni? Or is like Oni the word that encompasses?
Oh, no, they are very, they are their own thing. So Oni are, it's usually translated into English as ogre. And they are monstrously strong, sometimes giant creatures with horns. And in fact, there's a famous kid story that goes over Oni and Aka Oni, the blue ogre and the red ogre. And the red ogre wanted to play with kids, and they were too scared of him. So the blue ogre actually went to the and then suddenly one day, you know, the kids befriended the red ogre, had a great time playing, and they came back. And it's because, you know, the blue ogre decided to pretend to invade the village. The red ogre drove off the blue one, and then he became the friend of the village. And so he got to play with all the kids. And then he came home and realized that the blue ogre had to move away. And he sacrificed his home and everything else so the red ogre could be happy. So it's a very famous kid story. Tengu are, they are the mischievous group. They are usually depicted as having very long noses. They also have wings. Sometimes they have bird's feet. They can be invisible. They actually share a couple of commonalities with Jin in that regard, but they are tricksters, and they love to play pranks on people, and those pranks are often deadly in nature. But yeah, there's a lot of stories around Tengu, and they can sometimes be of benefit to humanity, but more than likely not. They love to play pranks, and those usually don't end up well for the mortals involved.
Yeah, that's really interesting. My interest in them, funnily enough, and I'm sure Dean, you're probably in the same camp, maybe, that, you know, we're both in our 30s and, you know, we're both gamers, and I was a huge fan of the Onimusha games for the PS2 and recently the Ghost of Tsushima games. And the reason I asked about Oni is because in the multiplayer mode, basically, you play with three other people and you're either a samurai, ronin, ninja, like an archer or something like that. And your whole goal is to protect like a village from an Oni invasion, which is pretty cool. So that's why I was curious.
Oh, yeah. And they're still extremely popular. In fact, there's an anime out this season called Undead Girl Murder Farce, in which the main character is an Oni, or part Oni. But yeah, it's fascinating.
I hear stories.
And I'm a big gamer myself.
I hear stories about, you know, that Oni, that like the good, or it was the blue and the red one, but like that was such a nice children's story. And I have to wonder when I hear things like that, like, there have to be, like, if there are really malevolent spirits out there, there are good spirits as well. And I wonder how many times they like step in to aid people. And I would also be fascinated to know if there were like stories about someone seeing or feeling like they were being saved in a moment of being attacked by a malevolent spirit, by some good spirit?
That is a good question. There's actually I think it's called Night of a Thousand Monsters. It's an older Japanese film, I think, that was produced in the 1960s, I want to say. Shudder had it in their lineup for a long while. Maybe it's still there. But it's kind of funny. It does show a lot of these kind of bakemono coming forth to aid this one village because of, you know, there's ancient shrines there and they're trying to protect it. So, yeah, you do find those stories. They're not nearly as common. Usually these spirits and monsters are more out of to seek revenge or to kill indiscriminately.
JJ, with regards to like Japan and ghosts and monsters and whatnot, how do people over there, like, what's the common way they ward them off? Do they like go to a kami shrine and like make an offering to, for example, the Hachiman to protect them? Or is it really like, okay, we make an offering to our ancestor spirit to protect them? Or is it like you mentioned, the Omori charms? Like, what are the methods that
the most popular are definitely Omori and salt put at the entrance ways in small bowls, one little bowl on either side of a doorway. Those are by and far the most popular. However, if something's really bad, then you can always go to a priest and they can draw up a talisman for you. And then you can post that talisman up on the affected area that's causing issues. Like, for example, let's say that, and there are a ton of these, you go and start looking at apartments in Tokyo or wherever in Japan, and you find a place that's ridiculously cheap. You're like, wow, I can't believe that. You know, it's a new construction, or, you know, it's only like a couple of hundred yen a month, or a couple of thousand yen a month, I should say. Yeah, that's red a red flag. There is a huge portion of the real estate market in Japan which are ridiculously cheap because they either can't keep people in there or something just absolutely horrible happened, and you actually get like an honest real estate agent.
I will definitely make a note of that when we do our sync up in Japan. I'm so serious about that, guys. Like, if we get big enough and, you know, we could get the funds and whatnot, yeah, man. I would love to do something like that.
I'm usually like there every December into January. So I'll be there again this
Although
year.
After your experience, JJ, I don't know if you would ever want to sit anywhere near a place like that to have a conversation.
it depends on how old the graveyard is. I get a sense that, you know, the more ancient, the worse things are, or the more historically relevant the worse things are. Like I have ridden a bike by several like newer construction cemeteries out where my in-laws happen to live. Didn't really suffer anything from that. I still put salt out after I came back home. But it's kind of bizarre. But I would, as long as I had the right protection methods, I would definitely have no Marty on me. I would have my salt ready for when I get home. But yeah, I would be more than willing to do that, because at the end of the day, I am still a chump and a sucker for those types of experiences.
Yeah, Chris, you would like show up with like just covered in like the talismans, just head to toe.
Oh, dude, you have no idea. I'd like go to the temple.
You get the extra protection, right?
Everything. I go get a katana blast, like make an offering to the Hachiman, like whatever kami you can think of. Yeah, yeah, I'm doing that. And on top of
that'll just undo everything. You're gonna cancel it out. Don't do that. So you either need all Jesus or all Japanese charms. It can't be like.
I combine both. Like when I go to temples, whether it's Shinto or Buddhist, I observe all the rituals. I pray at the temples. I've given respect to the local kami that are there, and yet I'm still Catholic. So I kind of believe in kind of more ancient Judaism, and because ancient Judaism, it really wasn't monotheistic; it was polytheistic. It never said you can't believe in other gods. It simply said you can't have any other gods before me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's true, huh? I never really thought about. I know that phrase, yeah. But I had never thought about it from that perspective. You know, one more thing before we get off, and I apologize for dragging on, but the last thing I wanted to ask you, touching on Judaism one more time, and you're probably the perfect person to ask this because I don't have any Jewish friends that I can immediately contact or talk to about such things. But is it true that some people in the Jewish faith believe that there is no afterlife? Like, once you die, you're just gone? Or am I misremembering or mishearing what some of them believe in?
No, that is true. In fact, that's the way it was for ancient Judaism. It wasn't that. So there was an afterlife. It was just Sheol, which is most commonly people translated as hell. But it really wasn't hell. It was just kind of a big cave in the ground. And you go there and you're a spirit and you just kind of live in the cave. It's neither a happy place nor a sad place. You just exist.
Okay. Yeah. Now, yeah. I was going to say Hades. We talked about
like
that.
Hades.
Exactly.
I don't know what's more terrifying, like just having things completely end and you're just gone, or being stuck in like a plane in a cave. You know, it's just like, I don't know which one is scarier. They're both pretty scary.
But then you get later interpretations of the afterlife, especially in Second Temple Judaism, where, you know, heaven and hell are right side by side. And it's only a very thin line that separates the two. So you get a whole lot of different interpretations. There's never one answer to anything.
Yeah, I feel like the three of us could have a whole other podcast on the afterlife and Judaism and the concepts of heaven and hell and whatnot.
That'd be really interesting. Oh, absolutely. In fact, we have a second podcast now, which is just taking, I think it's over 1,300 different paranormal topics, and we just have a random number generator that spins them up, and we sit there and talk about them as they come up. It's a lot of fun.
Which one is 666?
Oh, that's pretty neat.
Or I should say, in Japanese culture, which one is 444? Those or 999. Yeah, we should probably avoid those ones first. We'll save those ones for last.
Or at least in Christianity, it could be 616 as well, depending upon how you write the Hebrew.
I always found that numerology fascinating. That I think I may be wrong about this, but I think I learned at one point studying Mandarin that in some parts of China, the 666 is actually seen as good luck. However, 444 in any other Western culture is probably meaningless to most people, but it's obviously like death, death, death in Japanese and Mandarin.
Absolutely. And nines sounds like murder.
Oh, that's true, huh? Yeah.
That's why you never give a clock, because those are the fours and the nines.
That's right. I forgot about that.
But JJ, we've kept you for over an hour, and we're really thankful for that. And really, really thankful for you coming on to today's show, you know, and sharing your experiences and opinions and all these different topics from demonology, religion, Judaism, Japan. You really enlightened me on some of these topics that I wasn't really, you know, knowledgeable on. So I really appreciate that. And again, thank you for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's been a great fun getting to talk with y'all. I'm really glad I got to meet you. And do you mind if I just give a small quick plug?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
So, yeah, you can find me on Southern Demonology Podcast that has been going on since 2017, which in the grand scheme of things is a drop in the bucket. But to me, it's a long time. And you can find our website at southerndemonology.com. And we have a Discord server. We have everything else. So if you want to come by and listen, have some fun, always welcome anybody. And then, as I mentioned, we have a second podcast, which is called The Paranormal Roundup. And that's with a few other creators and myself. And we just have a good old time. That one's just starting up. I think we're about to publish episode 4 here on the 15th. But
thanks, man. Looking forward to that. Sounds great.
Yeah, folks, if you're listening to this episode, go ahead, give JJ a follow. Follow the Southern Demonology Podcast and the other podcasts that he has upcoming. His shows and episodes are really awesome. I've thoroughly enjoyed them, and I'm sure you all will. And remember, like we said last time, Dean, for an upcoming episode, rag on the hag. Thanks for tuning into today's episode of The Wandering Road. You can find us on Apple, Google, Spotify, and most podcast platforms. Be sure to subscribe and share. Also, don't forget to give a follow on Instagram at TW Road Podcast and follow my TikTok at TWR Podcast. Take care, and I'll catch you on the next one.